very exciting for me to be here tonight. If you had told me 10 years ago I was going to be substituting for Tara, I would have told you that you were crazy because I wasn't even teaching at that point. And I was thinking during the meditation that I had a career as a singer for many, many years. I was fairly successful at it and was very comfortable in my own skin wherever I went. Really didn't matter where I sang. I was pretty comfortable. And one night, a friend had asked me to substitute for her at a club here in D.C. And in the last set, all the jazz musicians that were finished with their sets came and sat in and came to watch. And I had the first panic attack I'd ever had singing because these were my peers. And so it was really interesting. And I was thinking during the meditation, there's just all this energy in my body. So it's a little bit like that tonight. You know, it's I'm very comfortable in my own sangha and the various places I teach. But this is Tara's seat. And so I'm grateful for the experience, though, and I'm going to sit with it. I'm just going to be with it. If we could bottle what's going on in my body right now, we could send somebody to the moon, you know. So anyway, again, my name is Mary Vandevanter, and I'm really excited because I just found this book over the weekend. My talk was all written and ready, and I was just kind of polishing it, and then I found this book, and then I threw everything out and started over from scratch. So I'd like to begin by reading a section from this book. It's a children's book, and it's called Tear Soup. There once was an old and somewhat wise woman whom everyone called Grandy. She just suffered a big loss in her life. Pops, her husband, suffered the same loss, but in his own way. This is the story of how Grandy faced her loss by setting out to make tear soup. For many years, the custom of making tear soup had been forgotten. As people's lives became more rushed, they found it easier to get soup from a shelf and cook it on the stove. But several years ago, Grandy got a taste of well-seasoned tear soup. One of her friends made it from scratch after her child died. As soon as Grandy tasted that rich flavor of this carefully made soup, she promised herself never again to assume that quicker was better. Because of her great loss, this time Grandy knew that her recipe for tear soup would call for a very big pot. With a big pot, she'd have room for all the memories, all the misgivings, all the arguments, all of the hugs, all of the feelings, and all of the tears that she would need for this stew. She put on her apron because she knew it would get messy. It seems that grief is never clean. People feel misunderstood. Feelings get hurt. Wrong assumptions are made all over the place. And to make matters worse, grief always takes longer to cook than anyone wants it to. So this is a lovely book. Grandy dispenses a recipe of very sound advice for people who have suffered a loss. At the end of the book, Grandy speaks to her grandson, Chester, I've learned that grief, like a pot of soup, changes the longer it simmers and the more things that you put into it. I've learned that sometimes people say unkind things, but they really don't mean to hurt you. And most importantly, I've learned that there is something deep down within all of us ready to help us survive the things we think we can't survive. Grandy asks Chester, "You know so much. What will I do after you die?" "Don't worry," the old and somewhat wise woman said. "I'll leave you my recipe for tear soup." For those of you that don't know me, when I'm not moonlighting as a meditation teacher, I have a psychotherapy practice in Alexandria. And when I'm not doing that, I provide support to groups and individuals in the aftermath of violence. Some situations might be an act of terrorism, a mass shooting, a kidnapping, homicide, suicide, natural disasters, and the occasional bank robbery. So I've worked with over 500 groups over the last 20 years, and I say this because, unfortunately, sharing on the topic of loss is something that I may be uniquely suited for. I wish it weren't always the case. When I first walk into a room to address a group that's been impacted by tragedy or trauma, I always wonder what to say. What are the right words so they'll let me in, so they'll feel safe with me, so they'll trust me, so they'll cry with me? How do I not come off sounding like some well-rehearsed funeral director? So those first few moments I speak, just like tonight, are really scary, no matter how many times I've done it. But I always ask myself this question. It brings me right back home. It's the same question I asked myself downstairs tonight. What is it that I really want to give them? And that answer is always really, really simple. I want to make it safe for folks to honor whatever they are feeling, whatever they are feeling. And sometimes people are spitting mad. I've had bottles of water sail by my head. I've had people throw themselves on the ground. I've seen a lot of different things through the years. I want to sell the idea that vulnerability is a rich and fertile soil. That's a tough sell. I want to provide some comfort and ideas about how to keep going, and I want to tell them that they're much stronger than they think. I've learned a lot about grief in my job and in my own life. It's messy. I don't have a formula, I don't have a plan, and I don't have any handouts. This from writer Anne Lamott. So where do we find grace and light? If you mean right now, the answer is nowhere. It's like after a child dies. Grace always gets up to bat last. But the light always overcomes the darkness. Always. Historically. But not necessarily later the same day or tomorrow after lunch. I frequently draw comfort from Anne Lamott's writings, and she has a Facebook page, and I found great solace, especially after some of the things that have happened in the last few years in this country. When the plane went down in the Pentagon on 9/11, it was carrying a friend of mine. It seemed like the end of the world for so many reasons, and I know that many of us felt that way. We all had questions for which there were no answers, not for a long, long time. We witnessed immense courage and selflessness and healing. And really, I've come to believe that that's what grief is, the end of everything that we have ever known, everything, and then regeneration. One of the lessons learned from 9/11 was the power of community to facilitate healing. And I always bring that to mind in the weekly class that I teach. Let us be grateful that we are sitting here together. And you'll notice I said it tonight, that we're sitting here together. Those who suffered the greatest losses at 9/11 fared far better if they stayed connected to friends and families and those who shared their circumstances. For instance, women who were pregnant and lost their partners in one of the buildings or the planes. People whose family members died on a given plane that stayed together in a cohesive group for at least a year. Those who's isolated had significantly more trauma-related issues and suicide. So in the immediate aftermath, it was really critical that folks stuck together with that mixed bag of feelings that we were all having. The horror, the grief, the terror, the anger. We cannot possibly digest feelings this big by ourselves. And yet, that's what we do, isn't it? It's what we try to do. It's the American way. Try to do this by ourselves. Many friends were glued to the TV, and others couldn't even turn it on. Some folks couldn't eat, and some of us couldn't stop. A few of us gave in to those bottom rung of the ladder coping strategies. Shopping, spending money, sitting in front of the TV for hours and hours. Some folks drank too much. People got in a lot of fights with kids and spouses. We felt like crap, but time moved on. We stayed connected, and eventually we survived. Being with one another was our best hope. I spent the weekend following 9/11 in the mountains with a group of women celebrating my best friend's 50th birthday. It was a tremendous blessing. We were so much kinder and more patient with each other than we might have been otherwise. In the book Tear Soup, Grandy speaks of special soup gatherings where people that understand come together and share laughter and tears. So some friends want to fix our pain. Others feel helpless when they can't do that. Some want to get as far away from us as they can. Big emotions can make people really uncomfortable. They're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing and make things worse, or unconsciously they might identify with the circumstances and worry that maybe they'll catch what you've got. I don't want to think about her husband dying. Then I have to think about the fact that someday my husband's going to die. So there's lots of reasons that people distance from us, and it rarely has anything to do with us or our grief. So we need to search for others who can make our own tear soup and help us with that. People who understand the value of being present and just listening. People who know not just how to say, how are you, but how are you today? Because these things change minute by minute. How are you today? Oh, it's so good to see you laughing. You know, I often have to teach people what not to say when I meet with groups of people who are undergoing loss, is to teach them what not to say to people who are, you know, experiencing the direct loss. And it's, you know, gee, it's so good to see you laughing, and I'm glad you've moved past this. And, you know, there's some things we never move past, never. And we're afraid that if we bring something up, it's going to stir something up for someone. And that mother that lost her child 5 years ago, she hasn't forgotten. It's with her all the time. It's really okay to say, how are you doing about Joe? I know it must be around the fifth anniversary. People really appreciate that, because it acknowledges that there's still something brewing there. I often wish that we would bring back the black armband, you know, so that when we have a great loss, that for a year people know that we're in mourning. It was a beautiful custom. Beautiful custom. So when sitting with someone in deep grief, I often say, please don't give up after the first four or five people fail the listening test. Or their eyes glaze over, or they change the subject. Share a little, and if it's not well received, stop. Try somebody else. Not everybody knows how to do this or possesses the natural ability to be with big stuff. It's scary when someone we know is hurting because we feel so helpless. Some of the people who are closest to us can actually even be taught how to be helpful when we simply say, your listening is so helpful, it's everything I need. For me, anger was such a frequent visitor in those days and weeks after 9/11. And anger and rage are some of the things that come naturally after great loss. Social media is a tempting playground for unregulated and undigested anger. At least it is for me. When we suffer great loss, we need to be gentle with ourselves as well as others. And when we blow it, we apologize and we start again. Sometimes helplessness makes us really mad. So we will feel a little better, but it takes time. And in all honesty, I don't like this one bit, that it takes time. But time is the only truth that I have come to understand about loss. Things will get bad. Things will get better. Wash, rinse, and repeat. It's like that, isn't it? It's a roller coaster. It's unpredictable. The concept of impermanence is the cornerstone of the Buddhist teaching. So all things external, people, places, things, and health, are subject to vulnerability, pain, and their ultimate inability to provide lasting and complete satisfaction. And I don't know about you, but when I first learned about this, it really pissed me off. When I first started reading about Buddhism and started learning about this notion of impermanence and how everything outside of ourselves is unsatisfactory, I did not like it. I thought it was anti-fun. And when I was in my 20s, that's all I wanted was fun. So I put the books away, and then when my butt was falling off, you know, 20 years later, I came back to it. So aging, of course, is the ultimate leveler, and one becomes more ready to accept this notion of impermanence as we age. You know, and I love that saying that some of us change our minds when we see the light, and some of us change when we feel the heat. And aging packs a lot of heat. So our practice is constantly teaching us that embracing impermanence eventually brings much deeper happiness, ease, and well-being. After the murders in Charleston last year, African Americans everywhere felt vulnerable and unsafe After the shooting in Orlando, our friends and family members who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, genderqueer, or transgender were terrified. My neighbor put security cameras all around his house. During the last several months, folks of every stripe have felt frightened. Deportations, ICE raids, and frequent public displays of racism and hatred have us all on edge. Over the past 7 months, I've had to deal with my own horror as I witness almost daily assaults on our democracy and our human dignity. Many of my clients and students have the very same concerns. These are very, very strange times. This past Saturday morning, I received a text from my best friend Martha. Her dear friend's son and another young man had been fatally stabbed aboard a Portland, Oregon commuter train after they tried to stop a man who was spewing hate speech from harassing two young Muslim women. I'd like to read what Taliesin's mom, Asha, wrote about him on her Facebook page. Taliesin Meche, my dear baby boy, passed on yesterday while protecting two young Muslim women girls from a racist man on a train in Portland. He was a hero and will remain a hero on the other side of the veil. Shining bright star, I love you forever. As of this afternoon, she had received over 100,000 condolences on this Facebook post. So that brings me to the topic of Sangha, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the role of Sangha in bearing loss. Sangha can be many things. Sangha can be a group of cherished friends. It can be a meditation class like this one. IMCW has many spiritual friends, self-led groups. They're called KM groups, and you can find them on the IMCW website. Also, there are 56 classes sponsored by IMCW around the DC area each week. Wow. I just came from an Intersangha conference in California last month, and there are sanghas all over the country. Theravadan sanghas like this one without a teacher. They're dying for a teacher. We have 56 of them. So there's many, many opportunities for sangha. Education about how to cope with life's most difficult moments is sorely lacking. And in the meditation class that I teach weekly in Falls Church, I like to pull those subjects out of the closet in order to demystify them. This incredible group easily shares joys and sorrows. I watch with admiration as they support one another through thick and thin. I'd like to read a selection from a book written by our dear Vipassana teacher, Tanisara. It's called Time to Stand Up. Meditation teacher and coach Sabine Selassie said, "Sangha is like the stepsister of the triple jewel. She cleans up and puts out the mats." Sabine is responding to the tendency, primarily in white-based sanghas, to use community as a support for individual practice rather than a vital part of our collective practice. If we put as much attention into cultivating a healthy relational field to support the development of beloved community as we do into our inner practice, we might find a revolutionized Buddhism. And in this next quote, professor and columnist Ahmed Safi observed that we gather huge crowds together to celebrate weddings and graduations, but hide alone in the shadows of shame when we divorce. He says, if we are a community, we should be together through thick and thin, for better or for worse. We stand together in the valleys and on the mountaintops. How do we make it possible for us to stand together when each of us goes through the valleys? Why do we celebrate together but suffer alone? Let us not suffer in the shadow. Let our grief be as public and shared, loved and supported, as we insist our joys be. So choosing to open our hearts in a life that changes constantly means that grief becomes a part of our lives. The possibility for loss is inevitable. It is surely embedded in our nervous systems. And that pretty much stinks. We're wired to seek the company of others and we'll lose them all, or they will lose us. Loving is risky. There aren't any guarantees. And it turns out, the more deeply we surrender to other human beings, and I should add animals, the more potential there is for grief. This from songwriter Leonard Cohen. I cried for you this morning. I'll cry for you again. I'm not in charge of sorrow, so please don't ask me when. So significant grief feels like a wound that heals really slowly. But if you fell down and you scraped your knee, you would not demand that it heal immediately. It takes time, and we want to bow to the fact that it has its own pace. In the lyrics by Leonard Cohen, he says he's not in charge of sorrow, and he doesn't know when he'll cry again. Grief is almost defined by its randomness, isn't it? When talking to a group of several hundred monastics, the Buddha addressed his own relationship with grief. Having recently lost two cherished friends, he said, "Without Sariputra and Moggallana, it feels as if this place is completely empty." So again, here is the irony. The heart leans towards love, and the world is impermanent. Dharma teacher Matthew Brensilver said, "We don't really understand impermanence until we lose something we thought we couldn't live without." When it cuts deep, grief can leave us temporarily decimated. It can feel like the ground's been ripped out from beneath us. And if you've experienced this, you know exactly what I'm saying. Whether it's the death of a child, a relationship, a longtime partner, a parent, a friend, this is a core piece of being alive. We love, then we lose. We love, and then we lose. In the Third Noble Truth, the Buddha tells us that there is an end to suffering. Yay! It ends when we come to understand that all things are impermanent and that we need to hold this life with that wisdom, but also with compassion. In 2005, I was on a retreat out west. I was pretty devastated over several losses at the time. I felt like I'd been hit with a tsunami and there was no ground under my feet. At times, I thought the grief would literally kill me. I was not getting any relief until I finally started to offer myself some compassion. Love and compassion were the only sane response to what was happening. So we all have our habitual ways of dealing with difficulty. Here's some of mine. Get over it. Very helpful. This will never end. Never, 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 never end. It always happens like this. I was not meant to be happy. That's the drama queen. She comes out every now and then. I was not meant to be happy. Or why are you crying again? You are so thin-skinned. So we grieve and then we judge ourselves for our grief. It's what we call the second arrow. That's what the Buddha taught us. When we can start to relate to our suffering with compassion, then we can relate to others in healthy ways. Not running away from them or merging with their pain, but just being with them. I've had to learn this in some very difficult circumstances. I mentioned to you earlier that I attend to groups and individuals who have been through pretty catastrophic losses and situations. I've had to learn how to just be with people. I've had to throw out everything I learned in graduate school. So I remember a day when I walked into a room and there was a man and he was on the floor and he was in a ball. I couldn't see his face. He had just killed someone, his coworker, by accident on a construction job. And I walked into that room and I thought, you've hired the wrong person. I don't know what to do. I have no idea what to say to this person. No idea at all. And I said, go back to what you know. Forget about doing the right thing. Go back to what you know. And so what I know is just be with. I learned this a long time ago when I worked with people with serious mental illness. And sometimes when I'd be hospitalizing someone that was quite psychotic, you have to be very, very calm. It's like anybody work with bees. You can start moving around bees, you're going to get stung. But beekeepers say just move very slowly. And so I thought of that. I moved very slowly, and I let him know I was in the room, and I told him my name, and I said, I'm walking towards you, because he couldn't see me, and now I'm going to sit down right next to you on the floor. My name is Mary, and we're going to go really, really slow. And that's where I started. So I'm thinking of another woman who had a gun pointed at her and someone jumped in front of her, which saved her life. But he was not so lucky. In those moments, I know I can't fix what's now fragmented, but I can bear witness to the suffering and help them find ways to keep going moment by moment. So we need to hear how we talk to ourselves in the midst of deep loss before we can come to our own aid. We need to develop that level of awareness. I have a very angry, critical person inside me. She always wants to point out how badly I'm handling things, but I also have a Buddha inside of me that sees that brutality and counters with tenderness. So it seems that many of us have these two parts, part terrorist and part Buddhist. So which one do we want to strengthen? So I'd like to just do a little reflection, and if you wouldn't mind coming back into a sitting position and allowing the eyes to close. So just taking a moment to remember a very difficult time in your life. It may be even be happening in the present, or it may be a while back, just taking a moment to call to mind a difficult time in your life. And as you think about this situation, you might ask yourself, how did I respond? Did I come to my own aid? Were you tender with yourself? Were you harsh? Did you give yourself space and time to make your own tear soup? Or were you impatient and frustrated? Perhaps it was a mixture of both. And so just allowing the eyes to open again. So then what are some wise responses to our personal losses and difficulty? How many of you know about the practice of Tonglen? Okay, so a few of you do. Tonglen is when we hold our own suffering. This moment is difficult. This moment is difficult. And then we send compassion to everybody else in the world, living, those who have passed away, who have had similar or perhaps even worse circumstances. So I'm going to have you close your eyes again. And imagining that difficult situation from a few moments ago and bringing the hand on the heart and saying inside yourself, this moment is difficult. This moment is difficult. And now imagine someone or many people who have suffered something similar or worse, a death, a rejection, a loss, an illness, an insult, and begin to send them all your best wishes. Hold them steady in the mind as you now join with them in this community, this connection. May you be at ease. May you be at peace. And just allowing the eyes to open again. So I find this Tonglen practice, and there's lots of different ways to do it, lots of information about it, and it's spelled T-O-N-G-L-E-N. Pema Chodron talks about it quite a bit. It's really where I first learned about it. And it's the thing that really comes out of the Tonglen practice that I think is so important is not only the compassion, but the connection to others, because pain is often so isolating. So that compassion and connection that we find in Tonglen really lowers our anxiety, lowers our fears, and gives us a sense of strength and perspective. It builds confidence in our capacity to stay with very difficult circumstances and not to collapse or go numb. So when we have compassion, we don't have to be so scared of our own feelings. I can't tell you how many times clients and students and people that I am serving in the community apologize to me for crying when that's what I'm there for. As God is my witness, I have never seen harm come to anyone because they sat with their sadness, ever. So when we're experiencing loss, there's something powerful we can meet with compassion. Compassion brings that friend in. I can't bear this alone. I need compassion. In the words of Sylvia Boorstein, let me meet this moment fully. Let me meet it as a friend. Let me meet this moment fully. Let me meet it as a friend. So another technique, and then I will be closing, is that I have found this extremely helpful, is to take my right hand like this and to take my left hand and just place it inside. So you see, I'm holding my own hand. Holding our own hand. Maybe even go like that. Holding our own hand. So it may feel silly, may feel embarrassing, it may feel phony, but it's a lot better than the stuff we usually do to ourselves, right? I'd say it's a good direction to go in. And if every time that we felt really upset, if we held our own hand, it would begin to become real. It would begin to become a pattern for us. It would start to change those neural pathways. And rather going down that punitive route, we would start to feel that sense of tenderness. And I'm sure you've heard Tara say this many, many times, that metta practice does not happen overnight. It takes years sometimes for us to ease up on ourselves and to bring that kindness in. So my own Dharma practice has been filled with grief. My first 10 week-long retreats were filled with buckets of tears, deep, old, multi-generational grief. I'm three-quarters Irish, so I call it potato famine grief. And I have to say, with all honesty, that those tears have freed me to be happier than I ever could possibly imagine, even in the face of lots of stuff not going my way. So we want to hold gently to the notion that each of us will experience 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. This was the Buddha's teaching. We learn to be grateful for the sweet and the sorrowful. It's just the natural order of things. May I be kind to myself. I'd like to close with this touching poem written by Mary Oliver after the death of her longtime partner in Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light. They are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning no one of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. And when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So I offer this for your reflection tonight, and some hope that some of this has been helpful for your practice. Thank you for your kind listening.